So yes, I think some of the major stakeholders on the river are tribes, both federally recognized and non-federally recognized, states, regions. There's the Tennessee Valley Authority, for an example, the Army Corps agencies, NGOs, both national NGOs, which we call the Big Greens, as well as the small state, regional, local, the general public, those who live and work on the river, along the river, but anyone who lives in a state that it impacts the river, in my opinion, is a stakeholder. Agriculture industry is a large stakeholder on the Mississippi River, both from a land perspective and navigation perspective. The vast majority of goods that are barged down the river are actually agricultural products. And then the navigation industry is also a large player. I think there are lots of communities that are impacted on the river because there is no like framework that's holistic. We can't really say like we're leaving people out, but in that large framework, but on a state base, there's definitely, you know, the same issues we see in the other basins that we see just across our country of who benefits from government programs, what communities are invested in, who bears the brunt of the harms the river delivers. You know, those burdens are not equally shared on the Mississippi River. And there are communities that don't really have a voice. I think an example that is used often, but should be, and it should be highlighted more, is Cancer Alley from Baton Rouge down to Louisiana. And this is a section of river that is actually very historically and culturally important. It was an area of a lot of slave plantations, and when those plantations closed, for lack of a better word, when slavery ended, those communities still stayed there. That is where they grew their families and are very connected to that land. And those plantations has now become a really large site of like petrochemical facilities, liquefied natural gas that have tremendous impacts on health impacts on the people that live there. The rates of cancer, why it's called Cancer Alley, are much higher compared to other places. New petrochemical facilities continue to get built, new ports to take in shipments of liquefied natural gas to then send that overseas so that people can keep making money, continue to get built. And those communities even are trying to fight those projects and are not heard. So I think, you know, these problems persist.
I think I'll just ask one more question, then we can open up to y'all to ask some questions. But I feel like we're a bunch of journalists in the room, so we're looking for stories. And I'm hearing a lot about how industry is driving policy in all of these watersheds, agriculture in the Colorado River Basin, as well as in the Mississippi, where shipping is a big industry interest as well, real estate on the Patuxent. So what are the implications of this? And Kelly, you just kind of touched on that. And how can we change it?
Sure. I'm thinking through that question a little bit. I think one of the things I've been thinking about most to kind of tie that question of industry influence into some of these governance conversations is that the way our water rights structure works really privileges certain users over others. So for instance, when the West was developed and we had things like the Homestead Act that incentivized folks to move to the West and divert water and green the desert and all of that, we created a system of water rights that essentially gave priority access to water to those oldest, or we say most senior users. Those are the folks in agriculture at the time, mining. And the users that came later, so the development of cities, thoughts about environmental preservation, those sorts of things, they got more junior rights, water rights. And that senior-junior thing is important because when water's short or we're in periods of drought, senior users get access to all of their water theoretically, if we followed the letter of the law exactly, they get access to all of their water before the junior users get access to any water. And so what that structure has created is our cities, I'll just use as kind of an example, who get 20% of the river are mostly junior users. They've had the incentive to become incredibly efficient because they have the most risk. They're the ones who are the most likely to be water short in any given year. So I'll give a little shout out to Las Vegas in my state, because a lot of people look at kind of the fountains and all of that and say, how are you doing this in the desert? But Las Vegas is incredibly, incredibly water efficient. We recycle 99% of all of our indoor water use. We have incredible regulations that govern not being able to use Colorado River water to plant in medians or grow. You can't have a lawn in new developments. We regulate pool sizes. It's a really intense structure, and that's I think has really been built up because of this legal rights system that forces kind of the burden on junior users. And agricultural users, while we certainly see innovation and things like irrigation improvements to like drip irrigation from pivots, things like that, there's overall much less incentive to adapt in the agricultural sector because those folks inherently have water rights that have less risk. And so we kind of have these two classes of users. And I've been thinking a lot about this lately because everyone is sort of pointing to agriculture and saying we need to conserve here. And I think that's right. But I think that we also need to remember that, like, we set up rules and policies to give that power to agricultural users. And so if we're going to take water out of that sector, you know, we need to start having conversations about, like, is this compensated? Like, now that we, you know, have moved as a culture to a place where we're not going to cut off Denver, not going to cut off Phoenix in a time of shortage, or, you know, we care about having environmental flows in the river to benefit species and habitat. Now that we're in this era, how do we deal with the fact that we allocated power sort of differently to an agricultural industry in the past? And you know, I think one thing that I'm still learning about that I think is really important, I have a student who's really interested in this right now, is how other laws and policies besides water also reinforce this. So subsidies to the agricultural industry, for instance, or the fact that we've allowed foreign companies to come in and get water rights to grow alfalfa to export overseas when we're water short in our own region. So I think that this question of kind of industry is also really actually tied to governance at its root. It's tied to power and money and these other conversations we've been having, but it's a governance problem too. And so that's, yeah, I guess that's my summary of how I think that could work in the Colorado River or how it does work.
So quickly, I think there's some illustrative paradoxes that I want to draw attention to. I don't think there's any synergy at all between activists and groups that are okay with being funded by pollution money and desperately need and want because of their overhead corporate funds versus the folks on the other side of the equation who want to sue and regulate those same parties. They don't belong in the same room, let alone in the same movement. They're really different movements entirely, and I don't know that that really goes recognized, that there's a whole undercurrent of alternate thought on this. The person who actually handed me the keys that made it clear in my mind how that works was actually Annie Leonard at Greenpeace. I asked her, why do we have to sit in these rooms with these people who don't really share our aims? They do in a general way, but they don't share our sense of tactics. They just want to know what we're talking about. They want to make sure that anytime we're talking about their meal ticket, they're in that meeting. And yet they fight us in the legislature. They fight us on policy stuff and other stuff. And she divided it into the transformative versus the transactional environmentalists, the folks who just want to save the bay, owls, whales, whatever they want to save. As opposed to the people who want to change the game. If there are any Trekkies in the room, it's the Kobe Mashi Ruru, right? It's you change the rules so you can actually win. We can't win under the rules that we're playing within most of these systems. The courts are really set up to defend these investors and these folks who are destroying these resources. The stakes are high. and they're being undersold by the corporate-funded side of the equation. So that's a paradox in itself. The other paradox is the idea that if we build the mass of these movements by embracing and building a bigger bandwagon of people of color, of indigenous people, literally people who are stakeholders, who right now are typified as, quote, diversity, which is shocking when you sit in a room and you're the diversity. It's abrasive. Wait a minute. We've got something to say about these resources, and it surely is not about getting on the bandwagon of these corporate movements. That's just not – they either need a bigger bandwagon or they need to confront the idea that white folks are not going to save the planet all by their lonesome, and the rest of us stand by and send donations and applaud and, you know, do all that stuff. It's a silly paradigm, I think, for how these movements roll. But there's a presumption somehow that if we change these movements too much – that will destroy these movements, which is also kind of shocking. Where has building a bigger bandwagon in American sports and entertainment and science, wherever, where have people of color ruined these movements? It's just bizarre. Yet there's a protectiveness surrounding these ideas that have failed to really produce the kinds of outcomes we want. The guy that said it to me best said, you know, we didn't really fail at saving the Bay. We simply didn't succeed to the extent we might have wanted. And I thought, that guy should probably run for office. Talk about putting a spin on something. You either win or you lose in these. That's the game we're in. You either save these resources or you don't. There's no in-between, right? If I tell you this is perfectly good water up to a point, you're not. You can't compromise. It's a gold standard. So to me, I think that those movements will always remain the same. That there are people who are in a bubble who think that corporate money is going to save the planet and we just have to fundraise our way to a clean bay. They're in their own room, and they need to stay there. The rest of us are going to fight like hell for these resources because it's all we've got. Like I said, the stakes are very different for us. It ain't about the crabs and the oysters. It's about survival. It's about public health. It's about keeping the duty out of the water. That's a different movement. And I think that we're not going to change that. And I think we have to confront and acknowledge that. Those movements that think these are perfectly great conservation movements, even without people of color in them, I have no use for those guys. I don't know what they're talking about. How could they? Like I said, they don't have the moral authority, and they sure as heck don't have the mass. They don't have the population mass to really carry the day on their goals. But it'll be a pretty cushy ride to perdition. I guarantee you they'll be on payroll. You know, that's what I think. So these are separate movements in some. And I think we have to keep it that way. And we have to acknowledge that. We have to acknowledge where the self-interest of people guides their level of activism. You know, if you guys have read Howard Ernst's work, you know, Chesapeake Bay Blues, he puts it on a scale from dark green to light green. And I agree with that. And I assure you, the dark greens are largely found in these unrequited communities who are under the jackboot of big corporate pollution, with no way to fight forward because no one's going to give them a grant. And so they have to find other ways to fight, the same way that civil rights, women's rights, human rights have always flowed. Those are the movements that are going to change the world, but they won't be funded.
Thanks, Fred. I'm going to quickly answer the question and then pivot to another thought that I want to make sure that I add to the conversation. So one of the success stories in our basin has been not just the regulation, but implementing change in a number of different areas to reduce pollution. One of the greatest success stories we've had is in reducing PCBs in the Delaware River estuary. And this actually is a story of deep engagement with the regulated community to come up with creative ways to implement a regulation, right? Oftentimes we see there's a lot of energy around passing the regulation, getting it finalized, and then how does it actually work? How does it lead to measurable water quality improvement? And that, as a science-based organization, is what we're really about, right? We're about measuring success. And the PCB reduction in the estuary was a years-long effort to engage the regulated community, to think about hotspots, tracking down sources, and looking holistically at the problem in a creative way that I think our commission was really uniquely set up to do. So I just wanted to flag that as a hopefully bright spot in thinking about and reflecting on our relationship with working both with the environmental community as well as our regulated entities. But I'd be remiss if I didn't mention, you know, in addition to our commission, since our formation, there have been two non-regulatory programs, right? So we are very much kind of that old school model of a regulatory agency with permitted discharges, permitted withdrawals, rules-based regulation, as much as we do, you know, really try to be nimble and lean into collaboration and innovation. But there are two entities that are non-regulatory that have really complemented our work and that we work very closely with. The EPA has an estuary program in, so sort of the bottom third of our watershed is an estuary, tidally influenced water, and that's hosted by the Nonprofit Partnership for the Delaware Estuary. We sit on their steering committee and help implement and drive, you know, their conservation, collaborative conservation plan. And then the newer one that I think is relevant to some of the other basins today is a Fish and Wildlife Service program for the Delaware River Basin. And this is largely a grant program that's funding restoration, improved access, community-based projects throughout the basin that really complements our work as well, improving habitat, strengthening communities, et cetera. And so both have had really good success engaging stakeholders directly and working toward our shared goals. And DRBC has partnered with the Fish and Wildlife Service Program as well in its early days, you know, helping to stand up sort of the governance structure and advising, as well as being part of that ongoing steering committee. So just wanted to leave with some bright spots there.
You know, sitting here, I think some of on the Mississippi, the implications are with things operating and kind of the status quo, the way they've always been, this top-down approach, the power dynamics that are staying in place, as well coupled with the increased impacts of climate change on the river, it is very hard to make progress. And so if we don't intensify our solutions and our imagination of how we can come together, and maybe those at the top give up some of their power, maybe I think that we need to change, and for the main thing to be about financial impacts, that also needs to change for there to actually, and behaviors need to change for there to actually have progress towards a healthy ecosystem that continue to provide drinking water for 20 million people and be the sustaining life force for fish and wildlife that also support people. You know, I think it's we need to realize that we are part of the ecosystem and communities are not outside of that.
Thank you so much. Do you folks have questions? I think I have to have you come here, come closer, and then introduce yourself and tell us which watershed you live in, if you know. No pressure. We hope you know.
Okay. Mark Schlefstein. I'm in New Orleans, so bottom of the Mississippi River watershed. I've seen each of you have different methods for dealing with the governmental issues that are involved here. But I see the Clean Water Act as a key piece for all of you. If you had your druthers and had the ability of changing the Clean Water Act, what would you change?
I'm going to just take an easy one and say the Supreme Court's recent decision in the Sackett versus EPA case. That decision is going to impact so many acres of wetlands in the Mississippi River Basin, and in the Mississippi River, many states don't have their own protections for these wetlands, or states are passing laws that are no more stringent than. So, saying when the Clean Water Act, given less strength in what it can enforce, and then states are saying you can't pass laws that are can't be more stringent than what the Clean Water Act, then it's actually not even allowing states to have their own solutions. And then again, just with the impacts of climate, I mean, wetlands are vitally important for a variety of reasons outside of climate change. And then with the impacts of climate change, they're only going to be more and more important. And so, you know, we see that, I see that as one of the I would change that like that if I could.
A couple of thoughts. We were started before the Clean Water Act, so we actually have independent authority under our compact. And our basin states generally refer or defer to DRBC regulations when setting water quality standards for the main stem river. So that actually has given us a little bit more flexibility in the regulatory space than some, you know, some other systems. But that said, you know, there are definitely challenges. And as I noted, you know, we still are not meeting Clean Water Act goals for fishable, swimmable waters. There's, you know, primary contact recreation is designated in all but a 27-mile stretch of the river, which sounds great on paper, but when you look at those 27 miles, that's this entire region, right? So just north of Philadelphia, down through Camden, New Jersey, Chester, Pennsylvania, Wilmington, Delaware, right? So really hot spots for centers of population, communities that really want to recreate on the river. I would say, you know, an opportunity in the Clean Water Act and thinking about specifically the state revolving funds, you know, the state revolving funds operate primarily on a state basis. So for an interstate system to get those states to coordinate and think about holistic improvements to a system or a region, I think is an opportunity that's just starting to be, you know, kind of talked about, discussed, and explored. So that would be one area I see a lot of promise in.
Well, as you probably know, the Clean Water Act is kind of fundamental to the waterkeeper movement. It's pretty much the only federal law that gives us, I wouldn't say the only, but the primary one that gives us a role to play as citizens in regulating these resources. I would agree with Kelly that the wetlands protections, which have largely been undermined, not within the Clean Water Act itself, but in common law, in courts, essentially, and these... My illustration how much I've changed. I was a journalist for 20 years before I became a riverkeeper. I thought those wetlands were swamps. That's what I thought. Right? I it's a swamp. Now I really understand the importance of these resources, and that's what's killing the Patuxent, right? We're losing wetlands. This swapping wetlands or essentially no net loss idea allows us to essentially destroy wetlands and replace them with swamps of inferior quality in some cases, or it's transactional in a way that doesn't really take into account the interdependence of these resources. So I would strengthen the Clean Water Act. I think some of the wetlands protections, I would strengthen some of the stuff that kind of goes directly to the heart of the ethos behind how we regulate these resources. And while we were at it, I'd probably take a hatchet to some stuff in NEPA. I think there's some problems embedded within the National Environmental Policy Act as well that get gamed by the system. And I think it's a war. I think it's a backhanded approach to how we regulate these resources. It's a miracle that EPA came into existence, let alone the Federal Clean Water Act, if you look at the history of how that went down. But going forward, like I said, these are going to be much more intense fights. Now we're, I think, fighting over what we have left to save, at least on the Patuxent watershed. We can't wind back the clock. We've lost much of the valued stuff. We're impervious surfacing the entire watershed. We're urbanizing that. Well, I fly it every year. It's a small enough river, 110 miles. You can get high enough to actually see it from beginning to end in a Cessna. And we're developing entirely along the course of the river. The infill areas are empty in some cases. Water is an attraction, right? It's a real estate boondoggle. Comprehensive planning, I don't know if there's some way for the feds to regulate that because it gets undermined. Essentially, nobody wants to follow that comprehensive plan at a county level because goodness knows it tells you where the real estate values are going to be next year. And so they essentially undermine comprehensive planning the moment it gets enacted. So there's plenty of handy targets, but yeah, let's start with the Clean Water Act. Let's get busy.
Do you want to say anything on that? Or?
I'll just quickly add, just to echo a couple points real quick, that the changes to the WOTUS rules also really critical for the Colorado River basin, not only for wetlands, but also for ephemeral streams. So I would definitely strengthen those protections, given what we know about groundwater surface water connections and the importance of those streams. And echoing one other point that a couple people have made, thinking about these river basins as a system, so not only across state boundaries, but in the Colorado River, across national boundaries, that's a big challenge for us. So how can we think about, you know, water quality rules and environmental protection rules across the U.S.-Mexico border and in connected water bodies? So kind of a new area that I've been paying attention to more in the Colorado River Basin is the Salton Sea in Southern California, which is primarily filled with agricultural drainage water now, and it's receding and releasing toxic dust into the air, and we see massively much higher rates of asthma among shoreline communities in the Salton Sea, lots of outdoor workers, those sorts of things. So I think thinking about how water works across jurisdictional boundaries, and then also how these water quality problems also are related to things like air quality problems would be another nexus that I would want to improve.
Other questions, folks? Somebody, ooh, lots. Somebody, come up.
Just shout.
My name's Devin Farmelo, and I live in the Colorado River Basin. And my question is about how you said that real estate is kind of running the show. And I feel like in the Colorado River Basin and just all across the nation, we see development and, like, just NEPA regulations just thrown out the window because environment, like you said, but sometimes environmental scientists are really just in it for the money. Do you guys have any, I guess, like, shining lights or just, like, some positivity in that aspect of where, I don't know, like, the actual environment is winning against real estate corporations and these really kind of crappy NEPA regulations that don't actually enforce anything?
I'll just mention two quick things. So we're having a huge debate about opening more public lands to development in Nevada and other places in the basin right now, and there is a really strong environmental movement pushback on that. And I think that voice is really important and is increasingly heard in the state, which I think is kind of a low-key win. The other thing that a couple places, this is pretty fragmented in the basin, but I know the Southern Nevada Water Authority is doing it. Cities like Chandler, Arizona are doing it, are thinking harder about creating, right now they're non-regulatory tools, but tools for assessing, like, water footprints of new developments. And so that, we talk a lot about smart growth. Can we grow in a way that actually fits kind of the hydrology of our region better in the future rather than just letting any growth happen? And I think we're getting to a point in some places where regulators and water managers are taking that very seriously, which is, I think, a win.
Let's keep it going fast because we have a bunch of questions. Unless you want
to
get in.
No, I don't have a lot to add. I mean, I don't know the Colorado Basin. I just know what goes on in Maryland. And my river only stays in Maryland. It doesn't go anywhere else. But I will say the ethos that I want to point to about land use is antithetical to many indigenous belief systems. For people who think we all belong in that same room, you're never going to sell pollution trading or any of that jazz to folks who fundamentally have a different point of view about what land is, who owns it, and who has the right to, you know, do nasty things to it. And I don't know that we have a conservation movement, one that is fixated on science, and I'm not by any stretch a science denier or anything like that, but it's only one point of view about these resources. If we don't have a bigger bandwagon, we can't win these fights. And yet, there's a fairly intractable point of view, I think, within the society, within the culture, about the entitlements to use land and to inherit it and what you do with it and how you apply it. So I do think that's a problem we have to confront. We need to clarify in our own thinking as conservationists, as activists, what ground rules are we following? And who do we want to embrace in these movements? And what are we prepared to change in order to get them on our page? I think it means a bigger bandwagon.
Yeah, stand up. Let's try to get as many in 10 minutes.
I'm curious about green infrastructure in each of your watersheds. What role do you see as part of the solution? To what extent? What limitations do you see in green infrastructure as part of the solution?
Did you all hear them? Green infrastructure as a solution.
What's up with
In the Mississippi, our organization and partners very much advocate for green infrastructure. Again, not to keep harping on it, obviously, you know, the Mississippi has a variety of locks and dams. It is a very structured river. 90% of the Mississippi River is channelized. So, you know, in places where it is possible, we would love to see more natural solutions and in communities. I could just give a quick example between, like, Davenport, Iowa, and Dubuque, Iowa. Both are communities along the river that experience flooding and wanted to make some changes to help their communities. Dubuque built a flood wall that is gray infrastructure that just pushes, you know, the water downstream. Is not helpful to anyone but those in Dubuque, but it also impacts how you can connect with the river when you have a flood wall instead of, you know, your riverfront. And then in Davenport, they made green infrastructure. It is a park, a baseball field that is all built to flood so that infrastructure can handle the impact of a larger flow in the river. But then the community still gets to engage and be connected. And that's like a much smaller, you know, smaller project. But I think green infrastructure plays a huge role. And I think one of the things that is not talked about enough is the economic benefit of green infrastructure, including the, you know, the upkeep cost of gray infrastructure is so high compared to green infrastructure. And so when we talk about these solutions, you know, there's many reasons why you should talk about them in a holistic way for the impacts on community, on animals, on finances. So.
Hi, Kyle. So you well know the Philly Green Infrastructure Plan. For those in the room that aren't familiar, the city of Philadelphia had green infrastructure embedded into its long-term control plan to reduce combined sewer overflows. It's called Green City Clean Waters. It's been in place for, I'm not even going to guess how many years, more than a decade, less than 20. And so I think there's been some looking at how well it's working, right? And I think there is a recognition that we need all the tools in the toolbox, right? That there are green and gray alongside working together to maximize water quality improvements as well as the community benefits, the nature habitat benefits that have been mentioned as well. I'll leave the time to others who may have more direct
So I think there's an irony. I think where you and I first encountered each other was when we were lobbying for a new stormwater bill in Maryland, and we basically heisted a lot of the work that Tracy Carluccio and others at Delaware Riverkeeper had done. And we got a lot of pushback in Maryland because the idea that we had policy and law coming from another state that didn't have Old Bay sprinkled all over it meant somehow that it wouldn't work somehow in Maryland. But essentially, here's what I'm driving at. We try pretty hard to avoid man-made infrastructure where it is not required. It's the last resort, not the fast resort, as much as some environmentalists can get paid to build that stuff. The problem is that in our law that finally got passed over much fighting and ultimately resulted, incidentally, in a mediation between the environmental organizations involved who were fighting each other, the idea emerged that we were preserving the existing hydrology in these watersheds to the maximum extent practicable. And we are to this day fighting over the difference between practical and practicable. And that the wordsmithing behind this stuff is so integral to what outcomes we actually get. So I don't have a clever, quick answer to the question, but I do point out that this infrastructure thing is changing these watersheds enormously. Sometimes these stream retrofits essentially are turning those streams into culverts to carry as much stormwater as possible for the built universe. If I were king, I'd live in a rural country, but I know that's done. We're not going to do that. And so we struggle, you know, day to day. You know, are we making a living or making a difference? You know, I mean, it's a hard struggle, hard challenge to figure those problems out.
And I'm not going to dive into Colorado River Basin details, but I'll just say that I was recently an author on the 5th U.S. National Climate Assessment, and every chapter was asked to consider nature-based solutions. So if you haven't checked it out, there's a ton on green infrastructure in there, and it's all online.
There's also been a lot of BIL money available for green infrastructure projects, but municipalities need to know how to actually apply for those funds. So that's not necessarily been very equitable. One last question. We've got 3 minutes. Oh, sorry. Was somebody?
I think he had his.
I chose that one.
Okay, cool. So I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas.
we are going through that fight right now in the Colorado River Basin, and I'm happy to talk details. I don't think I can do justice in just a couple minutes left, but I'll say, yeah, it's a complex mix of trying to figure out what our law actually says and also trying to get people to realize that you live in a system and what you do upstream impacts downstream, which I think is a fundamental thing that we're still missing in the Colorado River Basin.
That's why we exist. We're trying to help people understand that.
So I know we're out of time, so a very fast answer. Again, illustrative. At the original charrettes in the 1980-81, the legend is that the Howard County, which is where Columbia, Maryland is, those folks had to be brought to those meetings by the state police because they wouldn't show up if growth was going to be discussed. They didn't care what happened south of them. They were worried about their own infrastructure, economic future, all of that stuff. So that disparity between these seven counties on the Patuxent and the upstream interests, which are largely freshwater and kind of smaller streams, they don't know that there's an estuary in the south, nor do they care. They have no reality for it. If I go to Columbia, Maryland, and I give a speech about the Patuxent, people raise their hands and say, where is that Patuxent? It's like, can't you smell it? It's that stream right over there. And so, yeah, there's a worldview problem that we struggle with day to day to get people to take responsibility for those downstream impacts that they can't relate to, don't know about, have never experienced. Don't know a simple answer to it. It's you deal with it as you go along as best you can.
I just want to be respectful of everyone's time and wrap up on time. Thank you so much to our speakers who have traveled from all over to be here. And you're going to be here for a little while this morning, right? So if you have questions you weren't able to ask them, please just find them and ask. And I think we've learned a lot. There are many regulatory structures, mostly not working or very equitable. And industry is often playing an outsized role, so there's a deep need for more responsive governance structures that really serve diverse stakeholders in an age of climate threats and increasing resource scarcity. So lots of story ideas, I think, here. Thank you all. What? Back in 15. Back in 15, says Annie. Thank you.
Well, thanks, everyone, for a great start to our morning. I'm Annie Ropeek. Again, I'm the assistant director of the desk, and I'm a freelance journalist based in Maine and an SCJ board member. And I'm really excited to introduce our next panel. This was actually a panel proposal for the concurrent sessions, and it just seemed like such a great fit for this workshop. So we folded them in, and they've been troopers about being part of this crazy day. Our moderator... is Josh Toh. He works for A Growing Culture, which he'll tell you a little bit more about. And we also have Fanny Yin, who is an Uproot member and a freelance journalist based here in Philly, works on fisheries issues with the North American Marine Alliance. And they'll introduce their panelists, but this panel is going to focus on the idea of the tragedy of the commons, which I think we started to get into a little bit this morning, so that's exciting. And I'll hand it off to Josh, and I can show your org slides as you get to them.
All right, Tess. All right. Awesome. Thanks so much, Annie. Huge thanks to Annie, Sarah, Tegan, all the folks here in this room, all the folks supporting with tech, everyone who made this possible. So today we are going to challenge the tragedy of the commons. We're going to focus on real-world examples of land and water enclosure, offer alternative models, especially from the ground up, grassroots and indigenous stewardship of resources, and we're going to explore also how journalists can navigate these topics, challenge the status quo of reporting, and also report on these topics more holistically. The tragedy of the commons says that when left to their own devices, humans are bound to overexploit a common resource, perhaps through inherent individualism or greed. But there are plenty of communities living in relationships of reciprocity with land and water, some of whom are represented on this panel. In 2009, economist and political scientist Eleanor Ostrom won the Nobel Prize for her work countering the ideology of the tragedy of the commons, demonstrating that communities are capable of cooperating to sustain resources that are held in the commons and cooperating for the long term, from collective management of pastures in Africa to lobster fisheries in Maine, et cetera. Although this Nobel Prize winner was awarded in 2009, let's not fall into another myth that these alternative ways of stewarding land and managing resources is new. This is not new. This has existed since time immemorial through indigenous stewardship of waterways, oceans, and land. So we'll be getting into some of that today. On this panel, we explore the tensions between resource enclosure and communal models of stewardship. What is problematic about the dominant forms of enclosure or ownership? How does this impact ecologies and all living things? And we will discuss these topics in ways that challenge these myths. So that's the majority of my intro where you'll hear, that's the most you'll hear from me. Let's bring on Feini Yin. Feini, they are co-organizing this panel. Feini Yin from the North American Marine Alliance. Just jump in real quick.
Hi. Oh, okay. I'll just quickly share a little bit. So I have a journalism background and continue to do journalism mainly through my own documentary podcast project I'm working on. But for the purposes of this panel, I'm representing one of the fisheries orgs that I work for called the North American Marine Alliance. And so we are a grassroots alliance that's led by conservation-minded, community-based, small and medium-scale commercial fishermen. We are building a broad movement for a healthy ocean commons and just thriving fishing communities. So our network, through our networks, we represent and serve nearly 500,000 fishing families across Turtle Island, and who lead our work through decentralized organizing. So it's a little bit about, NAMA.
Awesome. And my name is Josh Toe. I'm from A Growing Culture. I should have said that in the beginning. We are a food sovereignty organization. We see a world where indigenous communities, though, represent just 5%, less than 5% of their world's population, steward over 80% of the Earth's remaining biodiversity. And as well, small-scale farmers, peasant farmers, and indigenous peoples are producing the majority of the world's food. These are the types of communities that are on the front lines of complex food systems, ecological climate crises. These are the types of communities that hold the wisdom of how to relate to land and work and live with land in a relationship of reciprocity, where resources are not controlled by the few, but resources are stewarded by the many and ensure that all ecosystems and all living things thrive. These are also the types of communities that whose stories go underreported. Their perspectives are often left out or sidelined in reporting and stories or left out of dominant narratives. And, of course, as a result, their solutions are under-resourced. So at A Growing Culture, just quickly, we work to bridge this gap between frontlines communities and journalists. We support journalists with finding sources who are on the front lines of these various environmental, food systems, climate issues from around the world, not just stateside. And this also includes press events, workshops on pressing issues. And our hope is that storytellers can lean on sources who best represent ecological and climate realities, and that stories just become more nuanced and holistic, and that we can also challenge the dominant myths in our world today. So that's really where my speaking ends. We're going to jump into the moderated session. We'll give a quick intro, though, for all of our speakers. We have Jillian Wall, and all of the names are up on the screen. Jillian is the director of storytelling at Sichangu Co. Sichangu Co. is the economic engine for Sichangu Lakota Nation's vision to create a healthy, just, abundant world for today and for the generations to come. Based in Rosebud Reservation, South Dakota, there they managed the world's largest native-managed buffalo range, where over 1,200 buffalo roam. Please update me on that figure. That's the latest figure I got. Buffalo, of course, are not only a keystone species through our, you know, environmental lens, but for the Sichangu Lakota, our kin, they are at the heart of culture, stories, healthy food systems, and maintaining a right relationship with the land. Jillian is passionate about reclaiming sovereignty, decolonizing political and social systems, and empowering indigenous identity through storytelling. You also find her podcasting, writing, and doing other community-facing work. Jillian, just give a wave. I don't know if everyone can see the name tags, but yes, please give a wave when I call on you. Next, we have Yesenia Funes from New York City, editor-at-large at Atmos, independent reporter and journalist who has been covering climate, environment, and race beats for over a decade. You might have seen some of her work in The Guardian or Vogue or Atmos, of course. Born and raised in New York, she's also a child of the Salvadoran diaspora, a founding member of the Uproot Project. You might see them here at the conference this week. This is a support network whose goal is to uplift journalists of color who have underrepresented in the industry. She's also developing the CARES Media Initiative alongside Climate Psychology Alliance of North America. They aim to connect audiences, reporters, and sources in building mental health resources for environmental journalism. We have Fanny Yin, media coordinator at the North American Marine Alliance, has a background in journalism and worked in newsrooms for the better part of a decade. They are now working on their own documentary podcast and storytelling project called Our Fishing Log, featuring Philly's local fish, fisher folk, and people who love to fish. Fanny also provides media and comm support for fishery orgs, including North American Marine Alliance. As you've heard, this is an alliance that is grassroots-driven, led by conservation-minded, small and medium-scale commercial fisher folk. They're building a movement for just thriving fishing communities and a healthy ocean commons. We have Kermit. Oh, Kermit's going to give a wave. A fourth-generation Philadelphia native, a writer, dreamer, and former teacher turned abolitionist, engaged in the co-production of knowledge, space, and resources in order to build thriving communities. However, his most important work these days is raising a beautiful child, cultivating a resilient homestead for his family in the same spirit of autonomy and self-determination which he infuses in all of his work. In his spare time, he's a geography PhD student at Temple University. His research focuses on resilience at the city block scale, bringing in food, land, bringing in water, food, energy, and housing into the commons and community control. He works in solidarity with multiple Philly organizations at the intersection of land, food, and environmental justice, balancing attempts to extract concessions from the state with a fierce commitment to abolishing all systems of domination today, tomorrow, and forever. All right, and finally we have Kellen LaCour-Conant, a two-spirit daughter of the Cane River Creole community in central Louisiana. She currently lives in Itihuma, or Baton Rouge. She works as a climate and ecology strategist with Taproot Earth to facilitate grassroots justice movements in her region and globally. She has a huge range of experience from working in wildfire and oil spill response to working with state and tribal governments in food sovereignty and land loss impacts. She holds a master's of marine and environmental biology, is a PhD candidate at Southern University under the urban forestry stream, and focuses on traditional ecological knowledge, which we'll cover more in this panel today. Kellen is an emerging leader with Interfaith America, an if-then ambassador with American Association for the Advancement of Science. When not occupied in one of these roles, you'll find her baking, fishing, or playing beach volleyball. Awesome. So I noticed in the first panel, we had a lot of discussion around policy and state-led or state-stewarded solutions. In this panel, we are going to navigate a lot of the from the ground up and grassroots and indigenous-led solutions when it comes to resource management. Before we get into the solutions, though, let's start with an opening question. We'll go around. Could each of you share one example of what water or land enclosure looks like in your region? And I'm going to start with Jillian, one example of what water or land enclosure looks like.
Hello, everyone. Okay, good. Well, I think a good example of this is one of our initiatives called Bolokota. So under Sichanguko, we actually have 16 separate entities that consist of nonprofit and for-profit entities. But you heard a little bit with my introduction about the buffalo, and so Wolokota is that initiative. And I like to talk about it because I always say it really is the heart of all that we do as Indigenous people, specifically from the Great Plains area as Lakota people. And so I'm speaking from a perspective of being located on the reservation. And so, as you know, much of our land we were put onto the reservation. So we have allotments, but we were able to use this in a way to our advantage. So our TLE, which manages the lands on our reservation, we were able to access 28,000 acres of land. And that is where our Wolokota initiative is. And so we're able to, over the last few years, actually very quickly, it happened a lot sooner than we thought it would, We have over 1,200 bison on the land who are doing amazing things, not only environmentally, but for the Sichangu people. Just for a little bit of history, trying to take away the Lakota people, they did that by taking away our food system, which was the buffalo. That's how we lived. So by bringing them back, we're starting to see our culture come back. We're starting to see the natural things that were happening in that area all come back and thrive. And I'll speak to more of how that's happening more on the panel.
Okay. So I'm actually from, I live in Philly, so welcome to Philly. But I'm going to talk about sort of fisheries more broadly. And so when I think of enclosure, I think of privatization. So privatization is happening across fisheries in the U.S. and corporate consolidation. One of the main mechanisms of consolidation is this policy called catch-share policy. It's or a group of policies. So catch-share policy is sort of a market-based neoliberal policy that really emerged in the 90s. So they've been established in fisheries from the 90s till through the 2000s up to more recently. There are now 17 catch-share fisheries in the U.S., including some pretty big fisheries like the groundfish fishery, which includes cod and haddock in New England, red snapper in the Gulf of Mexico, halibut and sablefish in Alaska. And so how catch shares work are they take a total allowable catch for a fishery, which is great. You know, we should be setting caps on total allowable catch based on stock assessments and whatnot. But then they sort of carve that total allowable catch into quotas that are allocated to fishermen through historical participation in the fishery over a given period of time, which is often contested. But then sort of where it gets, I think, problematic is that the quota are sort of treated as commodities, so they can be sold, bought, leased, and traded on an open market, kind of like the stock market. And so that's really opened the door for a lot of private equity, private investors to come and buy up fishing rights. So a lot of fishermen now have to lease the rights to fish, and often that has made their livelihoods totally untenable. The money they're getting for their catch is going to paying rent, basically, to what some people call armchair fishermen or slipper fishermen, basically landlord fishermen that own these rights, but they're not actually on the water. They don't live in coastal communities. And so the effect of that has been that it's really disconnected the access to the ocean and the fish from people that are living in coastal communities. And I think that'll probably be a theme of this panel, is just the importance of people's connectedness to their lands and waters. So I'll leave it there for now.
All right. Hi, everyone. So I live in Baton Rouge or Atihama, right on the Mississippi River. And so the obvious answer here is the levying of the Mississippi River, which, you know, during the colonial period, the ongoing colonial period, I guess, there were always small scale levees. But the vast levying that we see now, that came about after the Great Flood of 1929, where like Black and Indigenous rural farmers in St. Bernard and Plaquemines Parish were basically sacrificed to save other non-Black, non-Indigenous communities. And after that, the Army Corps of Engineers really, really lobbied for wide-scale levying across the entire Mississippi River, even though independent civil engineers highly recommended that outlets and more natural outlets up and down the river would be more cost-effective, would be more natural, would be safer for everyone, but less profitable. And so, of course, you know, the government went with what's profitable. And like any river floodplain, our delta is based on seasonal flooding of the river. That's where we get rich deltaic soils that makes Louisiana such a productive place. It makes it so beautiful. And without access to that seasonal flooding of the river that's contributing to our massive coastal land loss crisis. It contributes to the hypoxic zone or the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, which leads to huge fish kills, vast areas of the ocean that are just completely unproductive because of agricultural and nutrient runoff that is just funneled out into the Gulf with nowhere else to go, whereas otherwise, if it was flooding, that would help make the floodplain more productive. And then I guess today we can get into it later, but nowadays we're seeing kind of still conflicts of interest between what is profitable, what is political, what makes ecological sense, and then what would be equitable in terms of managing our river, in terms of land building, river navigation. All these things are still in play, is still chaos, and unfortunately the people who are most impacted are still not given the loudest voice or prioritization when it comes to these management decisions.
Hey, folks. So I guess my story will be a lot different. I'm in urban context. I'm in Philly. And the entire city is enclosed, right? I mean, you think about zoning. You think about individual homeownership and parcels. Like, the entire city is just a bunch of small enclosures. And so I think, like, when I hear Jillian talk about 28,000 acres, my brain actually can't compute that number. I don't understand what that means. Because we don't – in Philly, our increment is not even the acre. It's, like, the sixth of an acre. It's, like, it's square feet. It's how we operate, right? Philly has so you might have heard this number. Philly has 40,000 vacant lots. And you might have seen a story about that, like, say, in 2015. You're like, oh, but surely by now it's down to, like, 35,000. No, it's still 40,000. So as parcels get used, new parcels seem to become vacant. There's this constant sort of flow of use and disuse. I can say more about ideas of productive use and how people regard that, what's productive and what's not, use value versus exchange value, stuff like that. But anyway, the way the city's been zoned, and this is not just Philly, this is, most post-industrial cities, but it's to support car culture and fossil fuels, right? So you have this distinct separation between the residential areas and then the commercial sectors. That means that folks had to travel by car to get to what they need. And historically, what this resulted in is, like, you have this urban core that ends up being, like, gutted over time, right? Like, through economic downturns, people just abandon the urban core, and just nothing's happening. And in Philly, what that looks like, it's getting a little bit better over the past few years, but at a certain time, the city is just completely dead. There's nothing happening at all. It's just, there's business happens here, life happens here. You see a very slow movement in the direction of walkable cities, which Philly is for the most part. Depending on what part of the city you're in, like West Philly, walkable, Chestnut Hill, walkable, but the rest of it is not so much. South Philly, depending on the parts where you are. So it's a distinct separation between living in the industry and then in commerce. And so I would say that's the main example. And it's completely arbitrary also, not just arbitrary, but based on our political structure, people in government, city council in particular, who have district council authority can completely shift that, right? So, like, you might have something zoned for residential, zoned for commercial, but then they can arbitrarily say, like, actually, we'll give you a variance and say, like, you can build whatever you want to build here. And why they make those choices is more complex, and I can get into that later. But
I really love that response, Kermit. I live in New York City, which is also, like, a super urban area. So I struggled with this question when you shared it with us, because I was like, what is, like, the water or land enclosure look like in New York? And so I initially thought of the Hudson River and the history that the river has faced with, like, pollution from PCBs, sewage, automobile manufacturing. I remember when I learned about the tragedy in Commons in school, that was sort of, like, one of the iconic examples of what the tragedy of the Commons could look like in the real world. But after hearing you speak, Kermit, I want to talk about access to green spaces, because I think that in cities like New York, at least, depending on where you live, right, the green space, parks, lakes, access to wildlife is enclosed, right? We don't just walk around very often and see birds and wildlife or get tree cover. We have to, like, go there. We have to take a car there. We have to bike there. We have to take a train there. Depending on the neighborhood you live in, I live in a pretty nice neighborhood. I live in, like, I have a park that I can walk to. But growing up, that wasn't the case for me in the suburbs of Long Island, where we'd have to drive, like, 15 minutes just to go to the park and, like, experience nature, right? And so I think that when we talk about tragedy of the commons, when we talk about access to land, when we talk about land enclosure, water enclosure, it's also about who has access to so-called land, so-called nature, and how are cities now getting more sophisticated in making nature sort of holistic and, like, making nature everywhere, right? Because it is everywhere. But how are we nurturing that environment and, yeah, not closing it off so everyone can get to the park or get to kayak if that's, you know, what they want to do. So as someone who's always thinking about, like, mental health and, like, needs to get outside for my own sake, yeah, I just really, that really resonated with me what you said, Kermit, and want to emphasize that.
I think the whole, I'm trying to figure out how to not block. I hope folks in that corner can see. I'm not blocking. I don't know how Tegan did this, but like, I'm, like, blocking someone or I'm not talking to the mic at the right angle. Just as you were speaking, Yesenia, in terms of who has access, where to access green spaces or nature, this brings me back to the idea that in a lot of the stewardship of natural resources today, underpinning that, and we're talking about myths and narratives here today, underpinning that is this an inherent ideology of humans and nature separate. Like, these humans are going to visit and tour and, like, experience nature, and very much literally in a tourist way, because then, you know, or everywhere around the world, this kind of upholds the formation of national parks, where indigenous communities or local communities no longer utilize their lands and resources for food, water, medicine, but now those are just become areas to tour and experience nature, but not be a part of nature and one with nature. And I'll let the panelists expand on that themselves. But may back to Yesenia, is there anything you want to add in terms of what the commons or maybe the lack of commons looks like in stories you've worked on or stories you see being published?
Yeah, there is this one story I worked on, I think it was back in 2021. So in Brazil, there is a movement called the Landless Workers Movement. In Portuguese, it's known as MST. I wrote it down because I can't speak Portuguese. Movimento dos Trabalhadores Rurais Sem Terra. So it pretty much translates to Landless Workers Movement. And it's a massive movement across Brazil that is attempting to reclaim and resettle unused lands that are technically owned by someone. But there's this movement of smallholder farmers, peasant farmers, indigenous farmers who are trying to get access to land. You know, this is a country where land is massively concentrated among the most wealthy, among those with most power. And so there's a lack of access to that land, which is integral to both, like, sustenance, folks' ability to eat and make a living, but also, I think, as we're talking about here, like, culture, right? Like, people's ability to connect with the land. And so I wrote a story that looked at this movement, but also underscored the dangers that many of these folks face. So these are, like, you know, smallholder farmers up against these massive landowners who very often don't want to give up their land even though they're not using it. And Brazil has this really interesting clause in its constitution that gives folks a right to land if it's not being adequately used. And so this, you know, some 370,000 families have been resettled thanks to this constitutional clause and thanks to the landless workers movement. But the undercurrent there is heavy tension between the folks who own the land and then the folks who are trying to get access to land just to make a living, just to have food to eat. And I did a big profile on this one landless worker called Fernando dos Santos Araujo, who was killed in 2017 in a massacre where many landless workers were killed, and really looking at the tensions that exist when folks also have other identities. So he was also a gay man, and there was concern that he was targeted out of homophobia. And, you know, this is Brazil, in a country that has immense homophobia, both at the sort of political level, like, systematically. You know, there are laws and such like that that criminalize folks. And so the story really tried to shed light on this magnificent movement and the power that it holds, but then the power tensions that exist and the ultimately, like, the unfortunate reality that many folks are going to be experiencing, which can be death, which can be getting pushed off the land. And, yeah, I think that we need to sort of think more holistically about what land ownership means, like, who gets to own land, what does it mean to own land, what does it mean for folks to be able to interact with land and grow what they need, supply the country with resources like food, right? They're one of the biggest producers of food that is consumed in Brazil, the landless workers movement, because much food is exported. How are we thinking holistically about the different uses of land and who it's supporting, who it's helping?
Movimento Sem Terra, who also we've been blessed to, at Grown Culture, we've been able to work with also from a communication standpoint and capacity, storytelling capacity standpoint. They have over 1.5 million members. They're one of the largest landless farmer movements in the world. This is a country, and this reflects back to not just in the global south or in Brazil, but, I mean, is it much different here where a small portion of a wealthy owning class in Brazil, I think it's 1% of landowners control 90% or own 90% of farmlands. So that can also reflect back to our own geographies where there's a similar dynamic of power. Mm. Let's jump down to Feni. There's just so much. We could just keep going further down in history, because when you mentioned the concept of land ownership, I mean, this is a relatively new concept in human history. Our ideas of how to live in relationship with land have gone far beyond privatization and owning land. And you could even look at contracts or treaties between settlers and indigenous communities where that concept was very fraught. It's like, what is this concept? This is a weird concept. So we could go very far down the history rabbit hole. But let's bring it back to modern times, Feni. In our conversation with BJ McManima, Brenda Jo McManima, who Feni is filling in. BJ is recovering from a sinus infection. BJ said, all of our bodies of water are sick. And I'm sure everyone in this room has seen that in their own context. So Feni, how is the health of waterways and oceans connected to colonial or capitalist frameworks of ownership?
Yeah, definitely want to give a shout out to BJ. I am filling in for her, but can't really fill her shoes. So BJ works for the Indigenous Environmental Network, which you should check out. And so this question was originally intended for her. I'll do my best. Actually, earlier this week, I went to a talk by Robin Wall Kimmerer, who is the author of Braiding Sweetgrass. And so I can share a little bit of what she said about notions of land ownership or connection to land. There are other people on this panel that can share a lot more about that. She said that, in Western colonial societies, we're often thinking, what can we take of the land? What can we take versus asking, what does the earth ask of us? What does the land and water ask of us? And sort of seeing land and water as a source of belongings versus a source of belonging or a source of identity, land and water being teachers, sources of physical and spiritual wellness, connection to ancestors, identity, sustenance, teachers in libraries. So I'll share a little bit about that in the context of fisheries. When we think about the state of our fisheries today, there are a lot of problems. There's overfishing, there's factory fishing, industrialization. And if we want to talk about all that, we have to, talk about colonization and trace it back to the arrival of large schooners loaded with dories, which changed how people fished in Turtle Island. For the first time, people were able to go out to the fish to pursue them in a new way versus indigenous communities that were, fishing with the cycles of rhythm, the rhythms of nature in place, the migration cycles, the seasonal cycles, also engaging in methods of honorable harvest. And so when this method of fishing, you know, really when people were able to go out to extract fish on a new scale, I think that led to what we see now in terms of our relationship with fish and seafood, which is really a single species approach. We're fixated on a few prized species like shrimp, salmon, and tuna. A lot of these species are mostly produced through industrial aquaculture. And so in reality, you know, the U.S. actually, there are a lot of problems with fisheries regulations, but relatively speaking, the U.S. has really well-managed fisheries. You know, we're doing stock assessments, and there are actually a lot of fishery stocks that are doing well or have been rebuilt. And so even, you know, I'm pretty familiar with our local species, and we have a lot of an abundance of fish that people are less familiar with that are great for eating, great sources of food, like monkfish and porgy and tilefish and dogfish and skate. So I think, you know, I talked earlier about catch share policy. And so talking about the industrialization of fishing, you know, we go from the sort of arrival of colonizers to post-World War II. A lot of warships were converted to fishing vessels, so that also contributed to the industrialization. And now with these sort of market-based policies and things that really exclude and displace small-scale fishers, what we see is that that people are being displaced from this livelihood that often there's a tradition in their communities that goes back for generations. And I think that, you know, oftentimes in my work, we talk about, we contrast industrial with community-based. And how I, you know, how do you define those terms? How I like to think of it is industrialized fisheries, the distance between the people that own the operation and the people that are actually touching the fish and living in coastal communities is great. There's many degrees of separation. It's an extractive relationship where the people that own it are getting the profits are usually extracting it from one place and moving it to, they're not actually in the communities. Whereas with community-based fishing, these harvesters are harvesting in the communities where they live. They are on the water every day, so they are ecological experts. They are so familiar with the waters. They have generations of tradition. And when you talk about community-based, too, it encompasses that, you know, what is the case in one region is not always the case in the other. So it gets at how there's localized differences. And so, yeah, I think kind of continuing to riff on this theme of, like, the notions of these colonialist notions of ownership and the ways that we've structured things have really displaced people from these really deep ways of connecting with and stewarding their lands and waters.
Yeah, these are very deeply rooted systems, so we can all appreciate how much storytelling and structural change or grassroots movements it will take to maybe uproot and better unpack these things and then shift to alternatives. Kermit? Yes.
Yeah, just in terms of the idea of sort of Western colonial logics that we kind of take for granted, I just want to just, it may seem like a bit of a right term, but like, Fanny, we were talking about native cycles of waiting for fish and being in tune with the flow like that. Enclosure is not just about land and water. It's about everything that's subdivided, right? You even think about time, right? Time is – the idea that time is linear and broken into discrete segments, right? So here's the time for work. Here's the time for play. Here's the time for whatever. But that's not how it's been historically, right? And, you know, you think about like the relationship between the boss and the worker, right, is like, okay, well, we're going to enclose this 8 hours of time, and that belongs to me. You're going to work for me during that time. It's not even your time anymore, right? And it applies to schools, you know. So, like, you know, the young person who is in a class, so it's like, oh, English class happens for 45 minutes at this time, and then here's science class. That's not how we've ever learned historically, right, in terms of our relationship to nature and so forth. But also, like, and this is a kind of a random example, but, like, the idea of detention, right? So, like, if your kid is misbehaving in class, right, that the time that they've taken distracting the class, which belongs to the teacher, right, has to be paid back. So it's like, hey, you wasted 5 minutes of time in class. Now you have to give it back at the end of school in detention. So just so much of this logic is built into everything where it's like, things are just segmented, whether it's time, bodies, land, knowledge, everything is just really hyper, you know, sort of segregated and broken up. So I just think that, that reminded me of that.
You can tell Kermit is a father. Jillian, their indigenous approaches to stewarding land and resources, this is the exception rather than the norm in most of the geographies we come from, or maybe all of them. How does the Sichangu Lakota Nation view and steward land resources?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it growing up on the reservation, we're always told to leave home and you can't wait to grow up and be able to leave because you think you're growing up in poverty. But it took for me to become an adult and drive, to be able to drive 80 miles and not see a store or a house in sight to recognize just how wealthy we are as Lakota people. Recognizing that the land is our wealth, our culture is our wealth. We truly, I think, define wealth as very differently than Western culture does. And it took also the recognition that we at Sichangu Co. Realize that we know what our community needs and we know how to do it best. And that's how we really seen us thrive within the last 5 to 10 years. It truly happened so fast, it feels like. And taking it back to Wolokota, bringing back the buffalo, it's very difficult to measure on paper the impacts that we've seen. But I see it, and I'm so fortunate to be able to see it on a personal level, seeing the impact, you know, right in front of my face for people of all ages in my community. And so what that looks like is, you know, we have a Lakota immersion school where we're bringing back our Lakota language, and currently it's K through third grade, and every year we add on a grade. But it's very intimidating to be around these kids who are so strong in their identity. They know their language and they just show up so with, you know, no doubt of who they are. And it's intimidating, but it makes you so, so proud. And you imagine what that could look like for other communities who are able to thrive in the areas that they know best and they're able to thrive in their identity. Part of the things that got them there is being able to participate in buffalo harvests. There's something really special and spiritual that happens when you're able to participate in activities that your ancestors once did. And you learn amongst each other, you learn patience, you learned, you know, how to harvest a buffalo. You get to be a part of the entire process of providing for your community, providing food. And when the schools participate, our immersion school participates in this harvest, they're providing lunch, you know, for the following year. And so they're looking ahead. And I think what's also unique is part of the curriculum at the school is they're learning about water in one semester, and the next semester they're learning about the buffalo. So they already have the respect and they understand, you know, how to process the buffalo. They know what each part is used for. And these are just little, little tiny kids. And also within our ecosystem, we focus on food sovereignty. So within our community garden, we're also providing fresh, you know, produce to the school and also to the rest of the community. And this is all because of the access to land that we have. And that is not something, you know, as a young person going through a Western school system that I recognized. But now these young Lakota kids are on land every day. They you know, they have land-based learning. And that's just something, you know, we cannot take away from them ever. So
we are going to have open Q&A in about 10-ish minutes. So we're going to, we'll try to keep our responses short. Thank you so much, Jillian. To Kellen, maybe some folks in this room have started to see news or more coverage on community land trusts or other models of stewarding land and land resources, water resources. what are you excited about? What are some models or examples that get you up in the morning and that you want to share with the room?
All right, well, coffee gets me up in the morning, to be honest. And I have to add a disclaimer because I realize I'm in a room full of journalists who won't hesitate to fact check me. I honestly don't remember if it was the flood of 1927 or 29. So, like, don't judge me, but my point still stands. And personally, like, a lot of people know community land trust, conservation easements. These are good. There's a lot of benefits to those. But they can be difficult to navigate. For some people due to finances, bureaucracy, and also it's not the only solution when it comes to resilience or land stewardship. So some examples that I've worked with through the Women's Earth Climate Action Network and a network of Deltaic indigenous fem and non-binary gardeners and land stewards. We call ourselves Oklahina Ikesholo, or it's people of the Sacred Medicine Trail. And we're trying to revitalize our traditional trade routes along the Southeast Gulf region. A lot of Southeastern tribes kind of feel like, you know, they're shunted into the corner just because of the timeline of colonization. Our tribes and our communities were very early fractured, had to hide, had to merge with other tribes or maroon and freedmen colonies. So, the indigenous demographics of the Southeast look a little different. We don't have as many federally recognized tribes or reservation lands, so indigenous folks are trying to navigate land stewardship in different ways. And we have decentralized networks of land. So instead of one collective pocket of land that we're trying to steward, this network, you know, we'll have a food forest in Alabama and some urban farms around Bulbancha, New Orleans, Aritihama, some lands down the bayou. And so not only are we able to have a network of land that we're stewarding, it also provides us some safety if, you know, Houma is hit by another hurricane. We can't farm at Raccoon Farms anymore. But, hey, you can come up over to Hummingbird Springs in Floral, Alabama, and bring your trees with you, bring your plants with you, bring your people. So it's resilience as well as reconnecting the trade routes and also creating ecological corridors. And you see this happening in other parts of the world, too. We, at Taproot Earth, we're trying to make the world smaller in some sense for grassroots organizers who are often limited in how much we can travel and organize more broadly just through financial limitations or other things. And one of our partners in the Nile Basin area, Nile Journeys, they're doing similar type work, trying to bridge the gap between Nile communities from Egypt to Kenya to Tanzania, and similarly creating community resilience hubs that are founded in indigenous stewardship methods, agroecology, also reciprocity with land and local communities. And so you have multiple types of solutions, different scalability, centralized or decentralized. But that excites me, I guess.
Okay, I'm going to jump through a couple other questions, maybe one or two more before we start the Q&A. Imagine we're given a fresh slate. It's 2050. Private industries no longer control the majority of natural resources. What skills, infrastructure, or knowledge needs to be grown or capacity needs to be cultivated now in order to steward these resources in an equitable and collective manner? This was meant for Kellen and Kermit, but if anyone wants to jump in or if you want to give a quick response each.
Yeah, I queued up this question, so I guess I have to say something. I really resonated with what Fred shared in the previous panel, that we really have to differentiate between what's transactional and transformational. So I think that we need to change our mindsets to really challenge, are we not currently living in tragedy? Like, our oceans are supposed to be held in public trust, but we carve them up and privatize them so that companies can then sell us back our resources. So, like, that's a tragedy. Let's challenge our mindsets. We need to work on skills of critical analysis, collective analysis, reevaluate our goals. Is our goals generational happiness and identity and cultural wealth, or is it putting money in the pockets of your boss? And how we work together, we really need to strengthen our emotional intelligence, how we facilitate difficult conversations, how we see each other, embodying like Ubuntu, I am because we are, like, we're in this together. Our entire globe is our commons, really. And then also just the nuts and bolts of infrastructure. Are the people on the front lines of climate change, do they have the financial and legal and security infrastructure to fend for themselves, to really, be sovereign people? And how do we band our resources together so that we can make that reality?
I could add on to that real quick. I'll just make it quick. Adding on to what Kellen said, I like to take it back to the very basics. You know, I think about my grandma telling me when I'm cutting sage, hey, you don't need that much, so don't be cutting that much. It's that simple. We take way more than we need to, and that's what got us here. And so you just imagine what a world could look like where communities only took what they needed. And also, you know, don't take from the root. When you're cutting sage, you just cut the very top of it so it can continue growing. And so why do we make it so difficult? You know, it should be that simple. It's a simple example. And then I also think about my community who has, three grocery stores in the area, but you go there to buy some blueberries. It's $12 for some rotten blueberries. But I think about an individual in my community who has access to land, only 1 acre. I mean, that's a lot for, if you're coming from an urban area, but 1 acre of land on the reservation it's a lot. And she, you know, they grow their own garden. They took ownership. They said, okay, I don't want to pay that much at a grocery store for rotten blueberries, so I'm going to start my own garden. And that has turned into so much for them. You know, they now have three kids, and their kids already at the age of 4 or 5 years old know how to grow their own food. They now have chickens and goats. And that just took one community member to be an example, and it's inspired so many other communities, community members to start their own gardens. And that's something we also do at Si Chonggu Co. is our health initiative director. She just said, you know, the problem that I was hearing from the community is we don't know how to start a garden. So they went in the community and started 30 gardens for people. And more than half of those people are continuing on with those gardens. So it just starts with the very basics.
What I would say is that the whole idea of the tragedy of the commons is built on a certain assumption, which is incorrect, which is that every person will act in their own individual self-interest. And that's not how it's been historically, and that's not how it is for indigenous folks, right? So the issue of, like, overfishing or overexploiting a resource assumes that you're not considering the well-being of the people around you. So this question is about 2050, right? Like, sometimes people say things like that. I'm like, well, we're in 2024 right now. It's hard to even imagine how to get there. And how we get there is going to require organizing, right? So, like, another enclosure is enclosure of community, right? If folks are subdivided – through political divisions, through race, through class, whatever, they can't effectively organize to push back against systems of domination, right? And so, like, I think that when I think about Philly in particular, there's a whole lot of fights around land use, and you'll hear that many times from me, land use is really key, where there's battles between developers or between the city and gardeners. There's a story I'll tell really quickly about an organization called Neighborhood Land Power Project, and what they did was they overtook these parcels that were abandoned. Private owners just left them, you know, untended, and they started creating these gardens, and they were memorial gardens because they were in tribute to a few young people who were killed by gun violence. So they built these beautiful gardens. They were creating food for the community, and then they had support from nonprofits, support even from some people in the government, and then something happened where I remember talking about contiguous land. There's a lack of that in Philly. So the farm consisted of maybe like 8 to 10 parcels that were adjacent to each other. So if you look at it, it was a farm, right? But in terms of the city's designations, it was actually 10 separate parcels. So an owner of one of the parcels or a few within that farm decided they want to do something different with that. And so there's a pitch battle between the developer and this group to maintain this memorial garden. And in the end, they lost. And so the whole garden had to be destroyed just to have the developer create this one, do something with this one parcel. And so, like, what gives me hope, though, is that this fight continues. There's over 400 urban farms or gardens in Philadelphia, and the vast majority of them do not have secure land tenure. And so there's ongoing battles between the city and the land bank, all kinds of things I can talk about in more detail later if you guys want. where folks are like, the only way to maintain land and have this connection that we're talking about is to organize and fight for it. Because otherwise, developers just run roughshod over everything and just take. Yeah.
One thing that stood out in this collective abundance, or this picture, present picture of collective abundance, Jillian, that you painted in your community, is having access to land, land tenure rights, and peer-to-peer knowledge exchange on a very local level that built the capacity to bring this abundance. This might be our final question. Yesenia, objectivity is often presented. It's a pillar of journalism. People with power, however, people with resources, money, whatever, political, financial capital, will always have more visibility and access with journalists at the end of the day. They can more readily have their perspectives heard, their private sector-backed research, or their voices heard. You've been covering these topics for a while. What's your experience with this? How do you grapple with this as a journalist?
Yeah, I guess I want to start by saying that I don't believe in the notion of objectivity. I think that in journalism in particular, objectivity has been a tool to uphold white supremacy and to uphold narratives that benefit a select few and end up harming folks who look like me. And so for me, what the pillars for my journalism are truth and fairness, and understanding that everyone has their truth, right? There is like very many different truths that exist. And very often the truths that we hear in the media and that the media perpetuate are not the truths of frontline community members, Black and brown folks, immigrant folks, indigenous folks. And those are the stories that I think, especially in this collective moment as we confront, you know, what is arguably the biggest crisis ever, we need to bring those voices to the forefront. And so for me, you know, you mentioned like research and such, and that's always a struggle, I think, covering climate and environmental justice stories, is that there's this idea that like we need evidence to support this community's claim. And I think that that's another sort of problem that exists among journalism, that we need numbers and data for everything when, you know, testimonies of communities, in my opinion, is evidence enough, right? I think that we need to treat community members, activists, organizers as experts too. You know, what Fred was mentioning in the panel earlier really resonated with me, because I think that there is, especially in climate and environmental journalism, this obsession with like scientists and government officials, and very often trusting those voices and those voices only have led us here, right? Or industry people in particular, like the, you know, journalists perpetuated the idea that climate change doesn't exist, right? Like, we played a role in that. And so I think it's important for us to assess the flaws in, that are inherent to how journalism has traditionally operated, and that how that has led us here, and the ways that we need to, think more critically about the voices we bring to the forefront, who are the experts that we are uplifting, what are the stories that we dedicate time and resources to, and what is truth? What is fair? And who is actually benefiting from what we believe to be true and what we believe to be fair?
Of course.
Thank you, Yesenia. I totally agree. I wanted to add too, because I don't think we've slandered Garrett Hardin enough, the originator of the tragedy of the commons. So he was later exposed, you know. He was exposed as a eugenicist and white nationalist, but because he was an ecologist, his ideas became naturalized and seen as neutral science, objective science, like Yesenia was saying, rather than political belief. And so I think, you know, talking about journalists, like, I think it's important for us to not necessarily, you know, the tragedy of the commons, I think it spawns other ideas of like scarcity and greed. Humans are inherently greedy. And I think it's important to really question some of the underlying assumptions that we have in our storytelling and not see those as inevitabilities. You know, we've heard plenty of counterexamples. I think, you know, when we operate on these narratives that humans are inherently greedy, that our resources are scarce and can't be managed communally, that also justifies top-down conservation policies, right? So that's what leads to, like, the creation of national parks that displace indigenous communities from their land, or, you know, that we now see sort of, like, private industry forming partnerships with big NGOs, forming partnerships with state governments, and it's all, you know, it all feeds into each other that because humans are greedy and need to be managed, we need these top-down conservation solutions that ultimately, you know, when we think about, I know I've been talking about catch shares a lot, but I think it's a good example because by some metrics, you could say that it is successful. It has reduced fishing fleets. It has reduced the number of fishing boats that are out on the water. You know, so in that way, it is targeting overfishing, but it comes at the cost of communities that have longstanding connection and traditions on the water. And so, you know, I think that's an element that's really important to consider. And I think as journalists, I would just say, too, to, like, always go back to these guiding questions of, like, who owns it, you know, at what scale, who is harmed, who is benefited in your storytelling.
We're going to hear a final word from Kermit. Then we're going to switch to open Q&A. Prep your questions. I know we got some through the app already, so I'll bring as many as possible as I can.
So what I'm sort of stitching together in my mind right now is, you know, you said these comments about white supremacy and these ideas about sort of controlling, you know, who gets to use what. And so, like, sometimes journalists, the story that's being told is part of the master narrative, right? So there's an assumption that certain people know best, right? And then we think about, like, things like land use. It's like, what is productive use? What's proper use, right? And so, like, you know, the if I'm a developer and I'm building, you know, a four-bedroom condo, that's appropriate use. But maybe a community group is doing a garden. Well, that doesn't belong to them. Well, that's inappropriate. That's not a suitable use, right? So when you're asking, to this point about, whose stories get told, like, look into the kind of question this notion of, like, what's proper and what's appropriate and who actually holds knowledge, right? I think that feels really important. I really want to break the rules. Yeah,
30 seconds. It's that same thought process that justified the doctrine of discovery and manifest destiny. It's like settlers saw these vast, healthy, wealthy communities and natural spaces and thought, they're not developed enough. Let's do it for them because they don't know what they're doing. And so it's that same master narrative, really, that has been the foundation of so much bad policy.
Yeah.
Everything. Okay, that's it. Sorry.
And those were legal frameworks.
Yeah.
Climate change not being real was also used in a scientific framework to justify that climate change is not happening, et cetera. In my former days of research work, my supervisor or principal researcher said, for every research paper, there's an equal and opposite research paper. So she's like, you should look at systematic reviews and whatever, meta-analyses. But just keep that in mind. And I appreciate the point of leaning on perspectives and sources who are very much on the ground and who are intimately, very intimately familiar with what's going on in their ecosystems, their land and waterways. I noticed we have a couple folks eager to ask questions. We're going to officially shift towards that, I think, because we started the session late. Well, the session was started late. Let's just say we have 30 minutes of Q&A from here. And yep, did you have some? Yep.
Are you pointing at me?
Yes. Let's start with you. Just free for all. Just go jump in.
I have a question about grassroots and.
Ooh, tricky question.
Well, I guess I would challenge the idea that it's our job to convince people to change their mind necessarily. You know, I think that the conservatives. That's an interesting story too, right? Like, they're also community members. And so I think we need to also be thoughtful about how do we engage with these audiences, with these readers? How do we also bring forth their concerns, their perspectives in a sort of, you know, humane way, right? Like, we don't want to uphold problematic things, but I think it's important to engage with that populace. Personally, you know, as a journalist, I tend to avoid the populace because I don't see very many of them in New York, to be frank. But I do think, especially for, like, white journalists in the room, of which many folks are, I think that that's a really important role for y'all to, like, engage with those voters, engage with those characters and stories, because oftentimes it's safer for y'all to engage with those folks. And so how can you start, you know, asking them questions around climate change and environmental issues or rights of nature? What questions can you ask to maybe reshape their thinking? Or how can you include their narratives along the narratives of their neighbors that maybe they haven't communicated with, but they both want the same thing, which maybe it's just like, maybe it's NIMBYism, maybe they just don't want industry in their backyard, but how can you find unity in the sort of their narratives in your own storytelling? I think that it's a challenge, but I do think that I wouldn't say it's our jobs to convince folks to think any way or another. I think it's just our job to share their stories, whether that's critically, whether that's empathetically, and do a job of, like, bridging these different narratives together to tell a wider story, whether that's, if that's a story that, like, this wide community, this diverse community wants rights of nature, what is it that they all share? What is, like, the sort of common thread among them? And maybe by reading your story, folks will feel more empathetic toward others, more sympathy, more understanding. But I really encourage, especially like white reporters, to engage with those community members, because I don't feel safe to engage with those people, to be frank. And so how can you sort of use your white privilege to, like, help engage with them, get them to think more critically about climate change and environmental policy? And how can you help them sort of see the humanity in other community members that maybe they wouldn't engage with otherwise?
I think I'll bring in the panel, but I think there's a lot of a separation when it comes to responses to, let's say it's potentially the river being contaminated with fracking, whatever the situation is. One group will be, well, we care about this because this is our people's issue, because we don't want our, we live in this community, we don't want our water contaminated, whatever. And then people will, then there's an indigenous community says, we care about this because of this reason. And then we all start to conceive, well, that's their issue, that's a separate issue. These are all different groups. But at the very heart of all this, it's our resources being controlled or stewarded by the hands of the few or by the many. That's underpinning all of it, no matter the issue. So, yeah, does anyone want to?
I'd also recommend looking at different tribal nations who have incorporated rights of rivers, rights of different species, like the wild rice, into their constitutions as an example of what that looks like legislatively wise. Or
the problem with that is that, like, Minnesota got, okay, so the rice is, has legal standing, but they wouldn't let them give rights to the watershed because then it goes outside of their nation's boundaries.
Politics are never simple, whether it be tribal government, state, or otherwise. And then I'd also challenge journalists to challenge this America first, America the best, America only narrative. A lot of general people don't realize we're not first. We're far from first in a lot of metrics of, you know, health and wellness. And we don't ratify a lot of international treaties, whether it be the law of the sea, or so we're falling behind in a lot of metrics that other nations have already implemented, and maybe challenging this notion that we're behind the times in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I'm going to move to the next question. I think this came through the app. How do we look at and better understand the conflict or tension between urban sprawl and agriculture when it comes to land use change?
All right, this is me. All right. So the tension is actually kind of fabricated, right? In Philly, what it looks like is what I was describing earlier in terms of, like, people trying to maintain farms versus developers how that battle is framed is like, oh, well, we're trying to create affordable housing for people that don't have a home. But there's an entity in Philly called the Land Bank, which was created in 2013 through a whole bunch of activism. And the idea, the hope of that was that the Land Bank would dispense with property that was privately owned but abandoned or held by the city in a way that would, you know, bring it back into quote-unquote productive use. But in practice, the Land Bank has actually become just like a just an arm of the neoliberal government, right? They don't actually do much of anything. They've been around for over 10 years, and they've dispensed with very, very few properties, and almost none of them are affordable housing, actually. So the idea that, like, you had – I was saying earlier about how everything's separated, where you have residential – resident here, and then you have commerce here and industry over here. If we break that notion, right, where it's like, oh, how about you have agriculture and housing in the same location? What if you had an eco-village, right? You have multiple apartments in the same area, and there's an urban apartment in the middle of them. You can do both things, right? And because of the sort of structure of land in Philly, it being so – partialed out, you could have just like an apartment, a farm, another apartment. Like you can actually make it more integrated in that way. But in the end, this conversation is really political. So I don't know much about other cities, but in Philly, there's this, it's not even a policy really, it's just a sort of a gentleman's agreement, which is called councilmanic prerogative. And how it works essentially is that, like, any district council person has final land use authority over anything that happens in their district. And so, you know, if, whether it's, you know, whether a stadium's going to be built or a particular zoning variance or whatever, they get to, they can pass a bill and say, like, hey, I'm going to pass a bill that says this company can build the stadium, and this is actually happening now, build a stadium in this part of the city, right? Even though people around in the neighborhood are like, you know, this is going to be a problem for us, it's going to destroy our businesses, our culture, and so forth. In the end, they can just do that if they want to. But like, there's a whole council, right? So you would think like, oh, that person can't decide this unilaterally. But the way councilmanic prerogative works is that like, if a district council person says they want to do something, by default, every other council person will support them because they know when it's their turn to make a decision, they don't want the other council people to say no to them. So it's this weird agreement where like, I can do whatever I want, right? And this is, I can get some more complications around this, but like, in Philly, because it's such a democratic stronghold, a lot of people in council don't, they run unopposed for the most part. And even when they get opposition, actually, they have a mechanism to push people off the ballot. So if you are a politician who has supreme land use authority and no one's running against you, there's no incentive for you to do anything in accordance with what the people want. So when it comes to decide, time to decide, like, hey, should I give this land to a developer to build a stadium or should I give it to people to build an urban farm? People that are wanting the farm, they're rallying, protesting, and so forth. You're like, oh, cool, that's cute, you're protesting and everything. But in the end, nobody's going to take me out of office, so I don't have to do anything you say. Right, so we have a bunch of little small fiefdoms in Philly, and in the end, the conflict between urban development and agriculture is completely fabricated.
Yep. Go ahead. If you'd like, feel free to say your name and Philly.
Yeah, okay.
Recognized is that what I hear a lot from our people is, well, I'm really good at this or that, but I don't have a degree in it. And so they think that they have to have that, you know, degree because of the Western mindset without realizing that they have 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50 plus years of experience in this area. And so what I would like to see from the different storytellers who come into the community is, I have an idea for a story. This is the direction we'd like to go. But who in your community can you connect me with that could, you know, tell this story in the way that you think it should be told? I would like to see more collaboration within stories, journalism. You know, there are, I think in order for things to be different, you have to do things differently. So as journalists, you know, historically I've worked with, I'd say like 5 years ago, they would just come into the community with their, you know, they already have this perception of what our community is like and how this story should be told. And so they came in. I thought it was very extractive, you know, tell our stories for us in the way that they wanted to. But it sounded very mediocre, just like any other story I've heard in another Indigenous community. But it's the storytellers who come in with the basics of what they'd like to cover, but they allow us to truly tell the story. So I don't know how to, you know, I don't know if there's specific questions that should be asked, but I think it is important to work in collaboration with the community. And it might not be the direct person you're in contact with, but who can you connect me, who can help tell this story in a stronger way?
Yesenia Feeney.
Yeah, I think that it's important to also ask, like, okay, so if it's making this much money, where are the other costs, right? Like, especially, like, around health. I think that that's often not a question that people ask. It's like, what is the health cost of this development, especially, like, when we're thinking of industrial facilities? There's always, like, this is going to bring X number of jobs, and it's going to bring this X number of boost dollars to our economy. But what will it mean for the public health of communities? How long-term are those jobs? How many of those jobs are going to be local? How many of those jobs are going to be brought in from outside? What are the harms associated with this rise of a workforce? You know, there's been evidence around like man camps and pipeline infrastructure and the dangers and the harms that come with like an increased number of men in an area, sexual violence, human trafficking. Like it's important to also have a holistic understanding of what this disruption means for the local community. And I also love to ask folks, like, what would you like to see instead, right? Like, what is an alternative to this? Like, instead of a stadium, instead of a LNG facility, what would you like the government to invest in? Because oftentimes there are community groups who have really rich ideas for what they want to see, but there's no support, no resources to make it happen. What is another industry that could create jobs, but that can also benefit the environment, also benefit, again, health? Yeah, I think it's really important to be critical of those, because that's often, I read so many local stories about different industrial facilities, and it's always like, this is going to be a big boost. And I'm just like, y'all really don't question that? Like, there's so much more than just money and jobs for communities.
Real quick, I think the key sort of mental pivot, and so we live in a capitalist country, so we don't think about this breakdown, but use versus exchange value, right? This is the key thing. So in our country, we tend to think about exchange value, right? So how much money can that be made in exchange for the thing as opposed to the thing itself? So, like, rather than, you know, how much tax revenue can this stadium generate or this apartment complex generate, what value does this have for people generally, you know, in terms of, so you can raise tax revenue, maybe, you know, people get jobs, they can buy food from the market, or they can just grow their own food right there, right? So that shift, and this, to Jenny's point about environmental stuff, it's like, well, if I'm going to build an LNG plant in a certain neighborhood, I can see, like, oh, right, we're going to sell, and this is a real thing in Philly right now, they built the LNG plant in this neighborhood called Nice Town, which is already economically depressed and also environmentally burdened. And so, like, you know, Pennsylvania is the second largest LNG exporter in the country after Texas. And so for Pennsylvania and politicians, it's like, oh, well, we need to export this gas to raise revenue, right? But we're going to ignore the fact that the use value of that land, whatever it was before, is being destroyed. And this neighborhood, this community has higher rates of asthma because of the pollution of this facility. So in terms of the use value for folks, who cares about that as long as we're generating capital for the state? So that tension is key.
And I'll just totally along the themes of what Yesenia and Kermit were saying, I think you kind of already named, like, looking for those stories that talk about the intangibles, the intangible worths and assets. And, you know, it's something like urban farming. You know, if you look at just the food that's produced from urban farms, you know, it might not be actually enough to sustain the city, right? Or it might not even be, like, environmentally, like, the least carbon intensive way of producing food. But then, you know, what are the other things that people are getting out of urban farms? It's a connection to land. You know, it's immigrants and refugees that come from their home countries. And then, you know, they have those agrarian cultures that they can then recreate a sense of home. You know, it's a source of intergenerational teaching and connection. So, yeah, I would say lean into those intangible stories, too.
I think we had a question over here.
Just want to add on to that real quick. I'm really glad that you brought that up. I think it's very important to understand who your audience is. Whenever my very small team and I were talking, and we realized that even our own community is not reading the stories that journalists, authors, podcasters are doing on our community. They're not seeing the documentaries that are being made in our community. but it's getting a lot of national attention. And, you know, I heard from my colleague who was actually just featured in the National Geographic, and he thought nothing of it. It wasn't that special to him at the moment, but it wasn't until he got a hard copy in the mail and seen the magazine in his hand that he realized, whoa, I'm actually like doing something special here on Sichangu lands when it comes to food sovereignty. And so that was a realization that we had just last week, where we were saying, you know, we actually need to be more considerate of our local audience, because it's just every day for them. What they're doing is just a normal day. They're not realizing that they're creating economic change in our community, and that they're, what they're doing can actually be life-changing to the world. And so, yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
We have time for one or two more questions. Let's, you in the blue in the front.
Yeah, I mean, so I think Jillian's answer earlier kind of answered this question, right? So it's like you might come in with an assumption about what's happening in a particular area. Come in with no assumptions. Like, so you just want to come in like, hey, what's happening here, right? Let's see what stories people want to tell. I mean, you might come in thinking like, oh, this is what's interesting. But then that forecloses on other things that are happening that may be even more interesting from their perspective, right? So whoever you're talking to, let them tell you the story they want to tell.
Free to fill in.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on what you mean by doing it well, and I think that's a really subjective, you know, it's a really subjective answer depending on what, you know, good quality journalism looks like to folks. But I think that we need to make sure that as journalists and as newsrooms, and especially like editors and newsroom leaders in the room, that we put sufficient resources into those stories, right? Like, I do a lot of my reporting remotely, unfortunately, and it would be great to have resources to actually go in person and spend time with folks, to not have to feel like I have to get this story done in a week, to have the time to like really invest and learn and dig into the research, dig into the history, dig into the relationships with folks, invest in the stories in the sense of like visuals, right? Like, if there is some data element, how can you add that to give your story, again, that high quality feel? How can you invest in a photojournalist to accompany you? I think it's just like doing any other type of reporting that is high quality. It just requires a lot more sensitivity. And to be frank, it requires a lot more time, which is like a really scarce resource, unfortunately, for us journalists. We don't often have the time to do the story, I think, justice. So that's always sort of a battle, I think, in newsrooms, is trying to get the time necessary and ideally the resources necessary to go and do the story well by going in person, spending time with folks, and really, really helping illustrate what's going on there to your readers in a way that, again, is like effective. But it's hard because we all work in the industry. We know that it's a luxury to have those things, unfortunately. And so it's important to work, I think, closely with community members so that in the time you have, you're able to do a good job while being respectful and sensitive to their needs, while also meeting the really demanding needs of your newsroom.
This is going to be a little odd, but hey, Aaron, can you share like real quick specifically what grants have come from that?
Just.
Yeah, so Aaron is actually my colleague at Sichangu Co., and he's our director of development. But I honestly think like he would be a great person to answer this question if you could, Aaron.
Speak loud.
Yeah. Thank you, Aaron.
And I just want to add, I did a story for The Guardian last year that looked at IRA funding and how accessible it was. And the big consensus and takeaway from that was that it's really impossible for community groups to access that funding because of capacity reasons, because of how much time goes into those applications and how much, like, you need a really big team to first off apply and then to keep up with like the demands of the grant, if you even get it. There's all these like requirements and sort of like assessments and updates you need to provide. So I do think that's like a really ripe area for journalists to dig into, is like, what are the shortcomings of that? Who's not accessing that money? Who needs that money? On the flip side of that, though, there are like some bigger, I think, environmental organizations that are working in partnership with smaller environmental organizations that have been able to tap into some of those funds. And that's something that I'm doing some reporting on this year, trying to figure out, okay, where, who has gotten the money and where is there some like light at the end of the tunnel here. But I think it's important for journalists to look at this both critically in terms of like who's missing the money, but also like who did get the money, because folks are getting paid. And so who is getting paid is a really important question to ask.
Maybe let's have Kellen wrap up the final thought.
You got it. No pressure. I'll just add, in terms of party politics, for me, it's really like same bird, different wing. But something that was pretty indicative of this administration's commitment or lack of commitment to conservation or stewardship and where communities are sacrificed is the Gulf of Mexico 5-year lease sale that just recently came up and is administered by the Bureau of Energy, BOEM. I'm bad with acronyms. Mm-hmm. But one of the ways in that fell short was that there was almost a one-for-one trade-off. Like, you leases for offshore wind had to also be in tandem with additional leases for fossil fuel infrastructure, when communities in the Gulf are very strongly advocating for a transition away from fossil fuel infrastructure. We know that it's a dying industry. We know the climate impacts. But to us, that just seems like such lip service to invest in a potentially lower impact energy resource while simultaneously continuing to sink money into this very toxic industry. So for me, that's really indicative of the administration's priorities.
Okay, I think we're going to wrap up here. I encourage you all to lean on this panel and also lean on Feni Yin at North American Marine Alliance and also Growing Culture for sourcing of grassroots, finding sources of from grassroots indigenous communities, and of course this panel. And Feni, unless there's anything else, I think we're good to wrap. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you.